This week features an assortment of articles in the December 2024 Abolish Everything issue, where Reason writers make the case for ending Amtrak, the FDA, the TSA, and everything else. The Next President Should Abolish Everything, written by Catherine Mangu Ward. Pick at random any three letters from the alphabet, put them in any order, and you will have an acronym designating a federal agency we can do without. This quip was true when Milton Friedman said it many decades ago, and it's gotten only more true over the many years that George Will has been quoting it in his columns and speeches. The Constitution laid out a clear vision for the role of the federal government, one limited in both scope and power. Yet the government has drifted far from this blueprint. Departments and agencies now exist that would be unrecognizable to the founders, despite trillions in taxpayer dollars and decades or even centuries of meddling. These agencies have hampered economic growth, violated human rights, and eroded civil liberties. They have somehow managed to make air travel more frustrating, education more expensive, and drug enforcement more violent. What follows is an idiosyncratic and non-exhaustive list of parts of the government that we could surely do without. We've left untouched some functions specifically mentioned in the Constitution. Hello, United States Postal Service, and confined our ire to the federal level. We also had to limit ourselves based on the amount of room in the magazine. There's no love lost for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but we ran out of pages. And we tried not to repeat arguments for abolition that we've made in the very recent past. We'd love to abolish NASA again, but we've made that case before. We aren't making the case for anarchism, at least at the moment, merely hoping to highlight that the federal government was never supposed to be all things to all people. It's time to take a hard look at which agencies have earned their place and which are long past their expiration date. Sometimes reform is the answer. Victories for liberty can be and are achieved through gradual change. But sometimes, especially when it comes to bloated bureaucracies of dubious constitutionality, it's better to simply abolish everything. Abolish Amtrak. Why should the federal government run a transportation corporation? Written by Jason Russell. Who can resist the romance of the rails? The glorious train halls of old, the Art Deco travel posters, the hours-long stoppage between towns while the train has dysfunctional Wi-Fi, the cafe car is closed, and the stink of the bathroom by your seat is inescapable. Such is often the reality on Amtrak these days. One January 2023 trip from the Washington, D.C. area to the Orlando area, scheduled for 17 hours, turned into a hellish ordeal. Passengers had been cooped up in their seats or compartments for 37 hours, complaining of stale air, dwindling food supplies, trash piling up in the aisles, and a lack of timely information from the crew, read the New York Times report. Overall, one in four Amtrak trains is delayed, or one in two on routes over 750 miles. Amtrak blames freight train interference for most of its delays, complaining that when Amtrak trains operate on rails owned by other railroads, dispatchers ignore federal laws that require Amtrak get preference. Even so, Amtrak admitted to 21,654 hours of self-caused delays in 2023, a far cry from the 1990s when that number never surpassed 10,000 hours a year. It's no wonder Amtrak can't manage to make a profit. It was never expected to. The late Jim McClellan was on the Federal Railroad Administration's policy team during the legislative debate over Amtrak's creation. Most, including a number of us on the planning team, were dubious of the for-profit claim, but the reality was that neither the White House nor the more conservative members of Congress were going to sign off on an entity that was set up to be a perpetual ward of the state, he later wrote in his memoir, My Life with Trains. The for-profit mandate haunts Amtrak to this day. The only routes where Amtrak can make a questionable claim of making profit, in addition to the D.C. to Florida auto train, are in the Northeast Corridor, where regional population density is at its highest. These routes made a modest $202 million profit in fiscal year 2023. But overall, Amtrak lost $750 million that year, with almost $600 million lost on long-distance routes. Those financial numbers are somehow much worse than the FY 2019 numbers, even though ridership has nearly recovered to pre-pandemic levels. Northeast Corridor profits were 2.8 times higher in fiscal year 2019, and Amtrak overall lost only $29 million. Those numbers also don't take into account depreciation of Amtrak's assets. Amtrak owns 80% of the rails it uses in the Northeast Corridor, and maintaining rails and infrastructure is expensive. The corridor needs tens of billions of dollars in capital improvements, and the 2021 Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act will only put a modest dent in the backlog. But poor performance isn't the chief reason Amtrak should be abolished. It just helps the public get on the right side. The federal government simply has no business running a transportation company. Some might claim it doesn't, given Amtrak's status as a quasi-public for-profit corporation, but the Amtrak board is nominated by the president, and the federal government owns a majority of its stock. If it looks, smells, and runs like a poorly managed nationalized railroad, then it probably is a nationalized railroad. Amtrak's Northeast Corridor could be privatized, and private management may be able to use profits and private loans to chip away at the maintenance backlog. Brightline, the only intercity railroad in the U.S. that's privately owned and operated, is struggling to make a profit on its Florida operation, though its ridership is growing. The federal government gave the Nevada Department of Transportation a $3 billion grant to support a high-speed Brightline operation connecting the Las Vegas and Los Angeles metropolitan areas. All the long-distance Amtrak routes that will never be profitable, like a new temporary route connecting Chicago and Miami via D.C., should be put to bed, serviced by airlines and private bus companies. Amtrak doesn't even have good plans to make most of its long-distance routes profitable. In fiscal year 2029, for example, it expects to lose more than $600 per passenger on the Sunset Limited's New Orleans to Los Angeles route. If full-scale privatization is off the table, other reforms would certainly improve Amtrak's reliability and fiscal situation. But whether Amtrak is performing well or poorly is immaterial. The federal government shouldn't be in the business of doing business. No matter how romantic the golden age of rail travel may seem, its time is long past, and so is Amtrak's. Abolish the FDA. Many seriously ill people die waiting for the FDA to approve drugs that regulators in other advanced countries have already approved, written by Jeffrey A. Singer. It takes 10 to 15 years and hundreds of millions of dollars for a pharmaceutical company to navigate the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, regulatory process and bring a new drug to market. Many seriously ill people die waiting for the FDA to approve drugs that regulators in other advanced countries have already approved, a phenomenon called drug lag. It is impossible to imagine how many drug remedies remain undiscovered and how many people needlessly suffer because pharmaceutical companies must divert excessive research and development dollars to the drug approval process, a phenomenon called drug loss. Congress passed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, FDCA, in 1938 to ensure drug safety. The new law exempted drugs people had been using for several years, such as aspirin or regular insulin, from the FDA approval process. But it also required drug makers to henceforth provide convincing evidence to the agency that any new product is safe for patients to consume as directed. When Congress passed the Kefauver-Harris Amendment to the FDCA in 1962, it required drug makers to convince the agency a new drug was effective as well as safe, adding millions of dollars and several years to the approval process, inflating the length of time it takes the agency to allow people to consume pharmaceuticals. Strangely, when the FDA finally permits a pharmaceutical company to market a drug for a specific condition placed on the label, the agency allows clinicians to recommend the drug to their patients for any condition they think it might help. Anywhere from 1/5 to 1/3 of all medicines that clinicians prescribe and people consume are for these off-label uses. In other words, the FDA forces drug makers to prove that a drug works for condition A, but defers to clinical researchers in the private sector and academia to determine whether it works for conditions B through Z. Why doesn't the FDA defer to clinicians for condition A? Sometimes off-label drug use yields benefits. For example, clinical researchers found that the anti-nausea medicine thalidomide, which caused birth defects when pregnant women used it for morning sickness, was effective in treating leprosy and multiple myeloma when clinicians prescribed it off-label. Similarly, doctors recommended aspirin off-label to prevent cardiovascular problems. On the other hand, clinicians can discover that off-label use of a drug can be harmful or inappropriate. For example, some of the deaths from elixir sulfanilamide in 1937 occurred when doctors prescribed it for off-label purposes, such as Bright's disease, an old name for kidney inflammation, mercury poisoning, and backache. When it comes to off-label uses of drugs, endorsements of efficacy originate from entities distinct from the FDA. In addition to publications like Consumer Reports, these include peer-reviewed medical journals, the U.S. Pharmacopeia, and several other private compendia. Federal law requires the Medicare and Medicaid programs to rely on specific, privately compiled drug compendia to certify the efficacy of off-label uses. Similar to how the government grants physicians the freedom to prescribe prescription-only medications for off-label uses, it grants patients the freedom to use over-the-counter drugs for off-label purposes. The FDA even relied on a private third-party reviewer, the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences, to test drugs' efficacy from 1938 to 1962. The American Medical Association's Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry conducted safety and efficacy evaluations long before Congress passed the FDCA until it shuttered operations in 1955, crowded out by the FDA. Even then, it initiated a registry for reporting drug reactions. One intermediate step toward pharmaceutical freedom and progress would be for Congress to enact international drug reciprocity. This would allow American doctors and patients to access drugs and devices approved by regulatory agencies in similar, trusted countries. There is no logical reason why Americans should not have access to products approved in countries like Canada, France, the United Kingdom, Switzerland, Australia, New Zealand, and Israel, many of which have engaged in reciprocity for years. Many people can't imagine a world where the FDA doesn't have a monopoly on drug approval, yet there will always be a market for drug safety and efficacy information. Ending the agency's monopoly will allow innovation and competition into that space, benefiting everyone, even former FDA bureaucrats. Abolish the TSA. The agency has not made air travel safer, but it has made it costlier and more time-consuming to fly. Written by Robbie Suave. In response to 9/11, President George W. Bush created the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, bringing the country's myriad airport security protocols under one central authority. Two decades later, the results of this experiment are a complete disaster. The agency has not made air travel safer. The agency has merely made it costlier and more time-consuming to fly. The TSA has some 58,000 employees and a budget of $11.8 billion for fiscal year 2025. Its ever-changing screening process involves forcing passengers to wait in long lines, remove their shoes and sweaters, place their electronics in separate bins, and throw away liquids over a certain size, or to fork over a fee and personal information for TSA PreCheck. TSA agents riffle through luggage in search of contraband items and subject travelers to aggressive pat-downs of their genitals. Navigating these intrusive procedures often requires showing up to the airport much earlier than would otherwise be necessary, creating inefficiencies for the airlines and their customers. A Cornell University study suggests that some people choose to drive long distances rather than fly in order to avoid the headaches associated with airport security, which is both a financial loss for the airline industry and a net negative for safety per mile traveled. Car travel is much, much more dangerous than flying. It would be one matter if these post-9/11 protocols were necessary to protect airplanes from hijackers. But study after study has shown the TSA is essentially engaged in security theater, making people feel safe without improving safety. Undercover tests of airport security checkpoints have demonstrated that TSA agents failed to catch weapons and explosives up to 95% of the time. Moreover, reducing the number of knives on planes does not meaningfully contribute to airplane safety. The 9/11 terrorists were able to hijack the planes because they took control of the cockpits. That's no longer possible because airlines now require pilots to lock the doors. On balance, this one change has probably done more for passenger safety than a million genital pat-downs and confiscated cans of hairspray. We would be better off without a monolithic federal agency that controls all major aspects of aviation security, wrote the Cato Institute's Chris Edwards in 2013. More than a decade later, that's still true.